know there is a concept based on an absolute law that will attract to you greater wealth in all areas of your life. More money, more friends, more business, and more good health than you would ever hope to find if you went out looking for it. The concept is sharing, sharing the wealth. Sharing is willingly giving and graciously receiving. It is a prosperity cycle that anyone can make a part of their habitual behavior and is based on the same concept that keeps your hands and fingers and toes from going numb. It's called circulation. Wealth is abundance. Generally, when you hear the word wealth, it is instantly related to money. What you should do, instead, is automatically associate it with plenty. Some people are very wealthy, but unhealthy in their relationships. Others might be wealthy, but physically unhealthy. Wealth is about creating an abundance, or plenty, in all areas of your life. Hello, I'm Bob Proctor. The purpose of this particular edition of the Freedom Series is to assist you in creating an awareness of this ancient secret of sharing that will lead you to a lifestyle that is beyond the scope of most people's imagination. Many years ago, Willie Sutton was asked, "Why rob banks?" He responded, "Because that's where the money is." Willie was wrong, very wrong, and of course, it cost him. See, Willie had the law reversed. He thought if you wanted to get, all you had to do was take. But by doing so, he seriously sold himself short. If his mama had taught him that in order to get, you have to give, Willie could have saved himself and a whole lot of other people a lot of trouble. Now, while Willie Sutton is a real example, probably an extreme one, you know all kinds of people every day who are attempting to follow Willie's rules. In fact, 90% of the population has been programmed to follow Willie's rules. Though they may never think of robbing a bank in their effort to get what they want, they're going about their getting the wrong way, and as a result, they have nothing but struggle. This getting the wrong way and receiving the right way is all part of universal law. It is what Newton referred to as his third law of motion. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. The further Willie Sutton pushed to get the wrong way, the more intense the pushback became. If you're struggling with anything in your life, or if you feel that you're swimming upstream, stop your struggle for a moment and think, do you really think it's supposed to be this hard? Could you perhaps be going after this thing you seek with a get attitude? Are you pulling a Willie Sutton here? Because as odd as it might sound, a flat-out, unending struggle could very well mean that the law isn't on your side. And I'm not necessarily talking about the uniform and brass badge kind of law that dogged Willie Sutton. The law I'm talking about has a much greater impact on your personal life than Willie's Boys in Blue. Now, initially, you might want to reject that idea as nonsense, but before you reject it, let's analyze it. The results are always a good place to start. How many people do you know that have too many friends, too much energy, too much health, and more money than they'll ever need? I, for one, don't know many people like that, although I'll admit there probably are some. And while I refer to it as too much money and too many friends, that's an extreme example of individuals moving in the opposite direction than Willie was moving. Learning how to live a balanced, successful life is a lifelong pursuit. And since it's our life we're talking about here, let's analyze the faculties that we've been gifted with that actually enable us to live the life we want, to live in abundance, and fully utilize the concept of share the wealth. We've been given a mind and a body. We're given sensory factors to deal with our outside world, and we're given intellectual factors to deal with our inside world. And unfortunately, though we spend billions on education for our supposed intellectual factors, the vast majority of people are primarily relying on their sensory factors in a way that causes them enormous problems. In fact, most people are not even aware of what their intellectual factors are. Most of us are living out programs labeled sharing and wealth that were written by someone else and downloaded into our psychic hard drives before we could even walk. While these programs have faults in and of their own, They've each also been infected with viruses that keep most people in an even greater state of lack and limitation, even though abundance is as close as their breath. As we get involved in this magnificent concept, share the wealth, we're going to be discussing how this very concept is first interfered with and then how it can be promoted in every aspect of our lives so that our very lives grow rich in abundance. The three factors we're discussing are, first, our sensory factors, how we've been programmed to use them, and what we want to do to change them so that we use them properly. Second, our intellectual factors, how these factors enable us to take this great law of circulation that Share the Wealth is based upon and move into perfect harmony with it. And third, our competencies, and how, through simple exercises, we can become so competent at working with the concept of Share the Wealth that we don't even have to think about it. It can be done automatically. Does that sound appealing to you? Well, it's real. So let's get busy. Unfortunately, our senses rule the roost. I'd say that Franklin D. Roosevelt was one individual who so understood the concept of Share the Wealth that it was automatic. Elected President of the United States and unprecedented four times in a row, he was first voted to lead the country out of the Great Depression, then remained in his presidency to ramp up the country's participation in World War II, which established America as the global leader. Despite being crippled by polio in his late 30s, Franklin Roosevelt was governor of New York until elected president in 1932. At that time, he faced a country in absolute despair and true economic collapse. When Roosevelt first looked out on the Great Depression from the country's highest office, he innately understood that the people who were struggling during the Great Depression didn't know how to change what they were doing because they didn't even understand that they were making it the way it was. He had a plan to help his country come to a higher level of understanding, and it's a plan that I'll get to in just a few minutes. You'll see how he managed to raise a country to utilize its intellectual factors and then begin sharing the wealth. But first, let's think for a moment about the kind of nationwide attitude Roosevelt was faced with. An attitude as gloomy and forsaken as the scourge of dust that was simultaneously sweeping through the Midwest, creating the historical dust bowls that we still hear about today. Now, most of these people likely sat around thinking, the conditions and circumstance that are against us are so overwhelming that it is inconceivable that we could have brought this on by ourselves. This theory that it's someone else's fault, that what's wrong is due to some outside circumstance, is brought about because we were raised to live through our senses with no awareness of our higher faculties. Our senses are given to us to help us correspond and communicate with the outside world, and they can be used to enormous benefits when used properly. But remember, as the universal law of opposite dictates, with every enormous benefit, there's also an enormous detriment. The senses are a phenomenal benefit for us. As an example, you see the beauty of your garden, but when used incorrectly, these same senses can become your greatest enemy. As an example, you see the bank statement, and it's telling you that your bank account is empty. Your eyes have just given you news that can send you into your own depths of depression in a matter of seconds. You can see the beautiful garden, but you can also see what you don't want. From the first day we received a report card in school, our single sense of sight did the very same thing to us. But we've been conditioned long before there was ever a report card. How many times do you hear parents talking or correcting their toddlers with sentences like, "Will you look at this? Will you listen to what I'm telling you? Why don't you watch where you are going? Don't touch that." In every one of these instances, these parents are trying to force a change in their child's behavior. Now, is it all bad? Of course not. Parents are there to get us out of tangles, to keep us from plugging our fingers into light sockets, and to restrain us from crawling out a window onto a roof. But in many instances, whether harm stands in the way or not, The child's senses are beginning to relay a string of bad news to the child's consciousness. In school, it doesn't take long for the child to learn which report cards are good, who's consistently selected for kickball, or who reigns as the teacher's pet. The sensory input comes in, and the child's attitude and behavior begins to flip as fast as a switch. In other words, we're letting the outside world control what we think and how we act. Unfortunately, most people do not let their thoughts control the results. They permit the results to control their thoughts. That's a bad, bad deal. Now, if you stop and think about what we're really doing, we start encouraging children to live through their senses, which puts them in touch with their outside world. But because these senses are all that's ever exercised, we grow up thinking our outside world is all that we've got, when, in all actuality, our outside world is merely a reflection of what we have inside. See, our outside world and our present results should be considered a kind of thermostat on a wall. Most people who are unhappy with their present results will blame the temperature. We dwell on the temperature and blame an outside world for that temperature when, instead, we should be going directly to the thermostat, the entity responsible for the temperature in the first place, and adjusting the temperature there, which then changes our results. That thermostat represents our higher faculties. When we don't like our results, we should be going to our higher faculties to change things, but we're not even taught that we have these higher faculties. What happens when an entire country disregards the law of circulation? Now, let's get back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, looking out from his Oval Office on the first day on the new job, looking out at hundreds of thousands of destitute, out of work, penniless, homeless citizens. And he knew as he stood there the very core of the problem, the first domino that fell in a long string of dominoes neatly folding to the ground. America was no longer in harmony with the law of circulation. Sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? But it was indeed the answer. When the economic pillars of the country began to crumble, we must understand that some fierce God was not punishing America. The entire country was only learning firsthand what happens when the law of circulation, the law of sharing, is disrupted at many levels all at once. If the country had been living in harmony with this law, there would be no lack of any sort in any areas of these thousands of lives. The country would truly be living in abundance. When this same train of thought is applied on a personal level, individuals could certainly solve the problems in their life. If we could compare turning a country around to turning around personally, the country would be like an aircraft carrier and we would be in a canoe. A couple of good strokes of the paddle could definitely change the course of our lives. Thousands of individuals experience financial difficulty all through their lives. They live from payday to payday, forever trying to catch up. They're good people, people who are, in many respects, in harmony with this law we're talking about. But when it comes to money, everything seems to break down. And since money affects every aspect of our lives, it is essential that we get this straightened out, that we learn how simply and easily we can begin to share the wealth. As I stated earlier, when we don't live in harmony with this law, we're going against it. And a battle ensues. And that battle, my friend, is all uphill. By law, nature isn't set up to fight you, but nature will, always and forever, follow law. With a buoyant never-say-die attitude, Roosevelt laid it on the line. He told his American public that the problems behind the Great Depression were selfishness and greed. Can you imagine how shocked they must have first been hearing the radio address from their newly elected president? They probably wondered why they'd voted for him in the first place. But Roosevelt didn't stop there. As he continued his address to the nation, he said, "We've always known that heedless self-interest was bad morals. We now know it is also bad economics." As he offered his New Deal, Roosevelt pushed Americans to stop focusing on materialism and the making of more money than the next man, and to instead dive into community and public service. This alone, he claimed, would raise the nation. What Roosevelt was actually doing was brilliant. He was helping people understand, in a very unique way, that they should begin to focus on the cause of materialism. Focusing on materialism and the making of money itself was keeping them locked in poverty. That's right. There were probably a lot of people out there who not only wonder why they had voted for this fellow, but might have even figured he had a few screws loose. Can you imagine fixing an entire nation through community service? The country was billions of dollars in debt. 85,000 businesses had failed in a matter of 2 years. More than 9 million personal bank accounts had been wiped out. Entire families were actually living in dirt holes. And he's telling them to start sharing the wealth. But Roosevelt was not to be deterred. As he said, "Our recovery and ensuing comfort and happiness lies not in the mere possession of money, but in the joy of the activity that causes wealth, of the work and achievement for the good of others." See, Roosevelt was really teaching people to share the wealth. Perhaps he had taken a page from yet another great ruler, the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius Antonius, who's well remembered in history for constantly urging his citizens to contribute to the common welfare. As he said, "We were born for cooperation, as are the feet, the hands, the eyelids, and the upper and lower jaws." The next time you're in Rome, do as I did not too long ago. Get your picture taken in front of this great Roman emperor. He sits there on his horse, bigger than life, and like Roosevelt, he obviously understood the power of sharing the wealth. Roosevelt's wisdom and faith began to pay off. The nation began to comply. Even as the Depression bore down, people began helping people in any way or fashion they could muster instead of doing what they'd once done, turning their fellow Americans away from their doors. They weren't using money or bearer bonds to help each other. They were practicing the law of circulation. They were sharing their own wealth, the wealth they had inside themselves. In other words, America was waking up. And the wheels began to churn again, because people were beginning to understand. They were catalysts to putting great energy in motion. Although Roosevelt never called it masterminding, that's what he was actually encouraging on a massive scale. As a matter of fact, Roosevelt came up with the idea and promoted and pushed for yet another mastermind group. It's now called the United Nations. Masterminding is one of the greatest secrets to success that is known to man. It is a concept that has been employed by every wise and wealthy leader as far back in recorded history as you can go. I'll elaborate on this very concept, how sharing the wealth and masterminding go hand in hand, a little later. But for now, let's take a look at what happens when you start to wake up. Now, what happens when you start to wake up? To this very day, people around the world will sadly live out their lives just as most of the American citizens were living during the Great Depression, as unconscious incompetence. Unconscious incompetence rarely, if ever, rely on their ready-made, built-in higher faculties that already know how to create from an infinite source of supply. These are people who are losing. Nothing is working right. They're not doing very well, and they don't know that they're not doing it well. They don't even know why they're not doing it well. They feel as if they're struggling from morning to night. I was an unconscious incompetent through my mid-20s. It took an outsider by the name of Raymond Stanford to shake me and wake me up. He actually helped me become aware that I wasn't incompetent, that I wasn't creating anything for my life but despair. When something in your life shakes you up and rattles you around, when you start beginning to think that you could quite possibly be willing to do anything to get yourself out of the mire of life that has you hip deep, you move from being an unconscious incompetent to a conscious incompetent. I know it doesn't sound much better, does it? But it's the beginning to understanding. It's your new dawn. And it's up to you how quickly you want that sun to rise in this newer life. When you move into the realm of conscious incompetency, you begin to take responsibility for the life you've created. I finally looked in the mirror and realized I didn't like what I saw. I just didn't. You might have the sudden realization at your desk at work one day that this drudgery you've chosen is not what your purpose on this planet is about. So what do you suppose your purpose might be? I can assure you, your wonderful mind already knows what it is. It was Abraham Maslow who said, "A musician must make music. An artist must paint. A poet must write. If he is to be ultimately happy, what a man can do, he must do." One of my coaching clients, Tom Venuto, recently wrote to me and mentioned this Maslow quote, saying that for many years it has stood sentry on his desk. He continued by writing in his note, "I have an extreme aversion to unfulfilled potential. Maslow's quote just about sums up my purpose. What I can be, I must be. When I know I can do something and I want to do it, but I'm not doing it, I feel terrible and I know I'm off purpose. When I'm on purpose, as I am now, I am happier than I have ever been because I feel so connected to it." I want to thank Tom for sending that to me because I've benefited from it. But not only have I benefited from it, through this message, thousands of other people are going to benefit from it. This is a wonderful example. When you freely and willingly share something, there's no way of knowing how far reaching that good you offer goes. I am certain that when Tom Venuto first sent this to me, believing I could benefit from it, he never did it with the thought I'd be passing it along as I am. But the beautiful part of this is that all that good energy that he has set up is going to come back to him, and it will come back, pressed down and running over. So, what's itching at your mind? You might realize, as Harry Potter's author J.K. Rowling did, that it might be a good idea to write a fun children's book, to pull yourself out of the welfare line. Miss Rawlings is now one of the 50 richest people in the world. You might realize, as the founder of Bank of America, Amedeo Giannini, did, that when something even less catastrophic than San Francisco's great earthquake of 1907 occurs, setting up a table on a sidewalk and giving people whatever you can might serve your life purpose, and, meanwhile, absolutely invigorate the law of circulation. When the earthquake occurred, Amadeo's bank building had been destroyed. He loaned money, often with nothing more than a handshake, from a buckled sidewalk in front of his destroyed office, and in the evening would bury the bank records and remaining cash in his garden. The Bank of America grew from that garden to several branches. In 1916, and interestingly enough, was one of the very few financial survivors of the Great Depression's stock market crash in 1929. Imagine that. I wonder if Roosevelt had a grin or two about Giannini. Now it's the largest bank in the United States and the primary Hollywood financier. In order to realize this, though, you must first take an honest look at yourself, at your life. It takes looking at yourself standing there in the welfare lines. It takes looking at yourself in an overweight, unhealthy situation. It takes looking at your fears about what you can't do and why you've thought all this time that you can't do them. It's as if an innate wisdom inside you wafts down to whisper in your ear the truth. You're in a problem you haven't wanted to take responsibility for, and nothing is going to change unless you bite the bullet and act in the opposite direction. Remember Newton's third law? The law we've been discussing all along? Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. For some reason, you've taken an action that has you where you are today. By taking an action in the opposite direction, and that's the next step that you want to take, you begin to work toward fixing your situation. You're consciously aware of the fact that you're trying to fix it. I've mentioned before in other Freedom series that energy is never at rest. Because you're made up of nothing but energy, you are never at rest. You're either moving forward or sliding backward. When you choose to move forward, you become a conscious incompetent. You don't know exactly how you're going to fix it, but you're going to start doing something. Whether you know it or not, you're moving into the next stage, the stage of conscious competency. You're consciously working at being aware that you should do something, and then you should act on doing it. You're trusting your inner voice. You're following the guidance of mentors. You're consciously affirming what you want each and every day, several times a day. You'll find yourself beginning to act more on spontaneity. You're automatically doing things that are bringing that goodness into your life. You're putting out an energy, a giving energy. You're putting good energy into circulation because you're moving forward. And as you move forward, you're just doing it. You're not reasoning about it. It's like the Nike commercials that tell you, just do it. Their ads don't feature people who thought about running until it rained one day or considered rock climbing until they scraped their knee one day. Their ads show people who've gotten past the thinking. They know what they're doing is right. Their spirit is telling them that this is right. They're in their passion zone. They're just doing it. I'd like you to leave a space in the sharing compartment of your mind for masterminding. If you're not familiar with the concept, you will love it. It's a way of life for you and your associates to not only practice willingly giving and graciously receiving on a regular basis, it's probably one of the best forms of giving you will ever find. At that point, you've moved into unconscious competency. Somewhere along the line, your spirit, your inner knower, has gotten through to you. You understand that there is an infinite source of supply. You expect it, and you act on it, knowing that it is always there for you. You automatically give. It's spontaneous. If you have to think about it, it's probably trading. I'll come back to that point in a couple of minutes. So, why are so many people stuck? Now that you understand how the levels of growth occur, let's return to where most people get stuck, that unconscious incompetency. How is it that so many people just stay stuck there? We should be using our higher faculties to tap into an infinite source of supply, but instead we rely on our senses to tell us what we presently have in our physical world to determine our source of supply. Then, in our ignorance, because we see or sense this lack, we go out and try to get what we feel we need, which is in total violation of the law. We're taught to get. We're taught to trade. We see our meager store, and we're taught that this is all we've got. Lao Tzu said, "The wise man does not accumulate for himself. The more he gives to others, the more he has for himself. The way to heaven is to benefit others and not to injure them." When my kids were very small, I might have heard a wail out of Colleen coming from the family room, and I'd go in to find her crying. While Brian and Raymond sat there like cats that swallowed the canary, she'd claim that one of the brothers had taken her toy. They'd assure me that they took it because she wasn't using it. So I, in my parental wisdom, would set up the trade. I'd say to her, "Give him your toy to play with, Colleen, and he'll give you one of his that you can play with." We do this kind of thing every day. We teach trading instead of giving. We indulge in trading instead of giving. When someone invites you to a party, you feel obligated to invite them to your party. You're inviting them because they invited you. You feel it's in good taste. It's a form of trading. Trading sets up a form of unspoken expectation. Many of us deal with this in our relationships. We do this because we expect that in return. When our friend or partner or parent or child or spouse doesn't respond in the way we're expecting them to respond, we're disappointed or angry with them. See, we're trading. We're not giving. That's part of the programming. When it comes to trading, we're really trying to get. We're not trying to give. If giving is not spontaneous, like I said, it's very likely trading. I'd encourage you to objectively stand back and pay attention to your behavior. You might even surprise yourself with the unconscious trading that goes on. Giving, on the other hand, is good energy that you want to put out there, a lot. Quite simply, our purpose here lies in doing the thing that we love the most. It's fulfilling our heart's desire. We have an innate desire to be happy, and yet happiness escapes so many people, because they're not applying the law of sharing in their daily lives. The law of sharing is the fundamental law of circulation. It's our responsibility to serve or to give in every capacity we're capable of. Now I want to discuss how the true givers dot the timelines of history. A historian by the name of Val J. Helmanderas compiled a book on the 100 most caring people in history, which he titled Faces of Caring. As he noted, even Plato and Aristotle understood that life is not governed by blind chance, but by certain general operating principles. These principles are consistent, predictable, and quantifiable. Such principles are not limited to science, but equally applicable in the conduct of human affairs. How people are to treat each other. Helmanderas found that the common theme uniting many of the greatest people who have ever walked this earth was the element of caring. They understood the law of sharing. As he noted in his foreword, these people remind us that we are interdependent, that we both influence and are influenced by others. They remind us that we do not live for ourselves alone, that we are only temporary guardians of the truth. This requires all of us to move toward the perfection of our natures, to be all that we can be, and to reach our highest potential by first helping others reach theirs. One of my favorite profiles in this book focused on a man named Henry Landreth, who's still alive today. Born in 1927, Henry was just a child when he faced death daily in Auschwitz. After his entire family had died around him, he was put in front of a firing squad in 1945. Inexplicably, every one of the soldiers aiming at him lowered their rifles and told him to run. And run he did for 3 straight days until he collapsed at the feet of a caring countryman. He immigrated to the United States in 1950 with $20 in his pocket. 3 months after arriving, he was drafted into the U.S. Army. Without a complaint, he served his stint and then decided to pursue hotel management. In order to learn all the jobs within the hotel, he would often bribe fellow workers to allow him to do their work for several weeks at a time. In this way, he learned every job. Henry got married in 1954, and he and his wife chose an out-of-the-way place to begin a hotel, the Starlight Hotel in Cocoa Beach, Florida. Oddly, and within a few years, it was this very hotel that became home to the original Mercury 7 astronauts' families and media entourage. People say Henry was lucky, but Henry knew better. When Walt Disney made plans to build an amusement park in Florida, Henry purchased another hotel, the Holiday Inn, which turned out to be at the very entrance of the park's main gate. The more Landreth prospered, the more he did for others. He worked with retarded children. He built a center for children with cerebral palsy. He began citywide transportation programs for the handicapped. He set up emergency and financial assistance housing and meals for the state of Florida. And in 1985, he founded Give the Kids the World, a specially designed hotel and recreational complex for terminally ill kids and their families. As I was working on ideas for this script with my marketing director, she mentioned that after we had decided to include this story on Henry, she not only had a conversation at a dinner party a few evenings later with a gentleman who actually knew and worked with Henry for years at a hotel franchise acquisition level, but she saw a Give the Kids the World television commercial for the very first time, the very next day. Oddly enough, I had never heard of Give the Kids the World until just last summer, when my own brother, Al, and his wife, Beverly, fairly raved about it at a family gathering. We were celebrating my mother's 91st birthday, and we were all discussing how fortunate we were that all of our families and us were in such good health, living meaningful, interesting lives. And somehow or another, the subject moved to people who weren't so fortunate. For the last 16 years, Al and Bev have been strong supporters of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which grants terminally ill children their wishes. The two of them have financially supported many, many children and their families on trips to this Give Kids the World complex. And because they'd heard such great reviews from the kids, they decided to ask for a tour the next time they were down in Florida. As my brother explained it, the complex is so extraordinary that, well, certainly allowed and encouraged, very few children even ask to go to Walt Disney World, which stands a mere neighbor's distance from Henry Landreth's creation. Give Kids the World offers what you'd call a campus. Lodging in the form of beautiful modern cabins that act more like condos to accommodate all the family members. The restaurant franchise, Perkins, provides full-staffed restaurants and menu for the thousands of families in attendance and doesn't charge a dime. There are ice cream parlors, movie theaters, and a number of amusement rides, merry-go-rounds, and swimming pools that are all wheelchair accessible. They even have a stocked lake there for catching real fish. And all this, the entire multi-purpose, multifunctional park, is operated on donations. Henry Landworth got it started and, to this day, still provides extensive financial support. But thousands upon thousands of corporations and individuals like you are keeping the dream alive for these terminally ill and long-term illness children. I suppose I find it most amazing that while I only heard about this 16-year entertainment operation last summer, I never knew of the gentleman behind it, Henry Landworth, until we started working on this script. Look at what this one individual has created. Yet, he's not interested in getting or gaining the spotlight on the accomplishment. Henry Landworth understands the law of circulation, and he's passionate about it. Someone once asked Henry why he does what he does. To this he said, "I shouldn't be here. By all rights, I should have died. My whole life was a miracle. It's my duty to give something back. You've got to give of yourself, not money, but the essence of yourself. And then miracles occur in other people's lives." This giving, it's not a hard science. It only takes a few steps on your part. Zoroaster, a prophet in ancient Persia, taught that the idea of perfection begins with small steps. Take the first step with a good thought, the second with a good word, and the third with a good deed. Whatever we want to start receiving, we should begin giving. If you want to have friends, you have to be friendly. If you want to be loved, you have to be lovable. If you want to receive riches, you have to learn to give, to tithe, because whatever energy we send into the universe is the only energy that can return directly to us. Just look around at the way people hold on to things. They don't let go of it. You can be wealthy and be poor at the very same time. As Francis Bacon once said, "The desire for power in excess caused the angels to fall. The desire for knowledge in excess caused man to fall. But in charity and sharing, there is no excess. Neither can an angel or man come into any danger by it." People hold on to their caring or giving thoughts as well. Whatever for? If you like what someone is wearing, tell him or her. If you like how someone completed a task for you, tell him or her. If you appreciate the service someone provides, let them know. What does this take away from you? Absolutely nothing. All you're doing is putting great energy into circulation. If you're in a relationship, it serves you nothing to hold back or feel that saying something kind or caring might tear something innately away from you. We're inundated with opportunity every day to give compliments, to perform small acts of service. Take the opportunity. You'll find that as time goes by, you'll be moving from a conscious competency to an unconscious competency. It just comes naturally. You just give naturally. Because once again, you know there is an infinite source of supply. At some point, you realize it's not coming from you. It's coming through you. Luciano de Crescenzo put it well when he said, "We are all angels with one wing. We can only fly while embracing each other." Isn't that beautiful? Luciano's words are powerfully true, and you will never see them demonstrated better than in a solid, well-working mastermind group. Masterminding has been used by virtually every great business leader in past history. The only time masterminding does not work is when members of the group try to operate with Willie Sutton's rules. A true mastermind operates best with 7 or 8 members who are unified and come together on the same spot frequently, all wanting to give to the other. A mastermind member brings forth an idea he's working on or discusses a challenge she is facing, and every member of the group willingly gives whatever support they can muster. The person who is offered the idea graciously accepts the help that has been offered. Mastermind meetings are generally run for a specific period of time. They should not go over 1 hour. The meetings take place on a regular basis, unless an emergency arises for a member of the mastermind group. In our Share the Wealth program, we teach and emphasize the power of masterminding. If you do not belong to a group, you should definitely investigate how you can become a part of one. The poet and teacher, Edwin Markham, said, "There is a destiny that makes us brothers. No one goes his way alone. What we send into the life of others comes back into our own." That's masterminding. Since sharing the wealth is such an obviously powerful concept to live by, and yet runs in almost the opposite direction to the way most of us have been programmed, it becomes necessary that we make a decision that we're going to change that programming forever. This programming is actually a form of mental conditioning that has taken place through genetic and environmental conditioning. Conditioning can only be altered in one of two ways, either through the repetition of new ideas or through an emotional impact. Life Success Production has originated a 3-day Share the Wealth program. You can learn more about it at sharethewealthsymposium.com. And you might be surprised at what you find there as our gift to you, which we'd like you to extend as your gift to others. This program is designed to impact a person's way of living, a person's way of thinking, a person's decision to change their thinking. We want to help you stop getting and learn how to start giving so that the receiving is automatic. Winston Churchill once said, "We make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give." One of my most cherished poems reads as follows. It's by Arthur William Beer. "To get, he had tried, yet his store was still meager. To a wise man he cried in a voice keen and eager, 'Pray tell me, how may I successfully live?' And the wise man replied, 'To get, you must give.' As to giving, he said, 'What do I have to give? I've scarce enough bread, and of course one must live. But I want to partake of life's bountiful store.' Came the wise man's response, 'Then you must give more.'" The lesson he learned, to get, was forgotten. Toward mankind he turned with a love new begotten. As he gave of himself in unselfish living, joy crowned his days, for he grew rich in giving. Share your wealth. Begin today. It will enrich every aspect of your life. This is Bob Proctor, and thank you.